My name is Marty, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA, recovery is one alcoholic relating to another. Only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would be also helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Chris will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm an alcoholic. A preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Lynn will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Kathleen will read the traditions.
My name is Kathleen. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. One, each member of 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscious. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups as AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Giroux.
Hi. Well, thank you. Hi, my name is Giroux, and I'm an alcoholic. Neat. Okay. All right. I'm really excited to be here. And it's such a wonderful opportunity to serve a group in a small way, that has saved my life. Alcoholics Anonymous has without a doubt saved my life, and anything I can do, to repay that is not even touching the interest. The basics. My sponsor is Mark P. This is my home group. My sobriety date is January 13th of 2000, and I live today in steps 10, 11, and 12, and a little bit of 3. And, I loved alcohol. Like, it was the longest-running relationship in my life. There was just, it did something for me in a way that, I don't think other people got. And, I grew up in an alcoholic household, and if you're new, that's not a requirement for being an alcoholic. That was my experience. And, it was cool. Like, it was exciting to be a bartender at my mom's parties, at, 8, learning the difference between whiskey and bourbon. I knew it was important, and I wanted to get these things right. And, I couldn't wait for that day when, it was going to be me at these wild parties, because, I was a bit of a shy kid. And, and then it was me at those parties, and I wasn't a shy kid. I came alive. It's like I was waiting my whole life for someone to give me this thing, and all of a sudden, all the pieces just fall into place. I'm like, oh, I get it. these people aren't so scary. That guy's not so tough. That girl's not out of my league. I can do this. I can live. And my fascination with alcohol was always abnormal. I remember in 6th or 7th grade, we had someone come to our school to talk about his experiences with addiction. And, he would tell these great stories, and I just was riveted. And he talked about how, he would take oranges and take syringes full of vodka and shoot them up. And he'd have these, these walking screwdrivers that he could just take everywhere. And I said, I need to find syringes. I knew once I started drinking, I made this decision in my life. A lot of things changed suddenly for me. I had a relationship with a higher power as a kid. It was, the one that I was given, coming in the door. It's here's God, and there you go. And but I dug it, and I was about it. And I really, I liked having a connection with God. And then things with my family, being in an alcoholic household, sometimes there's a little drama. And when that fell apart, I turned my back on God, and I'm like, this guy's not helping. And then I turned towards the thing that was helping. And, that was a big shift. And I knew that, I'm going to, chase this thing all the way down to the finish line. I'm going to pursue this whole drinking life like a professional. And that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be the professional drinker. Kids would get, have their 3 or 4 wine coolers, and they'd fall down and pass out and throw up on themselves. And I just held them in such contempt. I would remember getting to parties, you know, a little bit late for some reason, because God knows I wouldn't be late at a party if I could help it. But like, when kids were already halfway drunk, I would be furious. Because, like, I'm not where you are, and I have to catch up, and just don't even talk to me, because I'm going to be too busy drinking for the next, you know, hour or two. And, you know, at first, you know, it was working, and I did feel, like, a part of, like, that whole, like, you know, okay, and the camaraderie, and the, I love you, man, you know, oh, you're the best, dude. Like, you know, like, when it's working, and you're like, this is great, we should get a bar together when we grow up. And, like... You know, or like we'll have a resort in the Caribbean, and we'll just invite all our friends to live there. Like these were my wildest dreams, okay? And you know, like it, but it was working. And all I knew is that this was the only thing in my life that was really working. And so, like again, I considered to pursue it some more, and like you know, with a lot of focus, you know, just you getting right into it. Where did that take me? My last year of drinking was a pretty scary place. I developed insomnia, and, you know, I would stay up every night, like, you know, 6, 7 in the morning, you know, with these legal pads where I'd just write down everything that was wrong in my life. And, you know, I could see everything, every twisted, deviant, horrible thing I had ever done, all these, like, warped aspects of my personality that was, you know, separating me from my fellows, and, you know, just how much trouble my life was in, you know, coming to the end of my first senior year of college with, you know, six, you know, heavy five-figure habits and no life skills and no job skills for sure. You know, these were problems, and the only thing I couldn't see was how alcohol connected to it. But, you know, towards the end, you know, it wasn't fun, but, you know, like, alcohol was giving me, you know, 8 hours of oblivion. Like, I drank for the blackout. You know, I just wanted to be unconscious. I didn't want to feel. I didn't want to know what you... Don't tell me what I did last night. You know, we just, you know, if we make eye contact, then, you know, like, I'm going to go this way because I'm sure that I burned you, you know? But... It was really just a painful existence, and alcohol still was my solution to that pain, you know? I knew it wasn't helping, intellectually I knew, but I hadn't found a solution yet. And so, you know, when I came, you know, crashing into here, you know, in right after, you know, Y2K, and, you know, the world didn't end, and I needed a new plan, that was my exit strategy. You know, the apocalypse, excellent. So, you know, I came in here, and I needed something. And thank God someone told me that, you know, it's like, we have a solution. You know, there is a solution. And I was willing to listen to whatever nonsense you were going to tell me. You know, I'm like, sure, okay, that sounds great. You know, like, yeah, no, pay things or whatever I have to do, like, I'll do it. You know, I was desperate because, you know, like, drinking myself to death was taking just too long, and I didn't have the strength anymore. And, you know, fortunately, the solution turned out to be, you know, something I'd always been looking for. You know, since that day, you know, when I was 13 and decided I didn't need a higher power in my life, I had chased after it in various other ways. I'd felt that distance from a higher power. I'd felt, like, a disconnect. And when people are like, why do you have to live like this? Why do you have to act like that? They didn't understand. They're like, why are you so crazy? How could they know that I was a broken thing and they were whole people and they didn't have to do what I had to do? And, you know, I just thought I was crazy and broken and fundamentally wrong. And, you know, so I pursued something, you know, something to take me away from that. And, you know, I looked to every other thing but a higher power. And so when I came in here and I was given the choice, you know, you either find a higher power or, you know, continue on the way you were doing, like, I started looking. And, you know, the good news is that, you know, it says in our literature, it's like, if he, you know, if our higher, you know, God couldn't would if he were sought, not if he were found. And, like, you know, my understanding of a higher power is still nebulous. I can't pin it down. I can't, you know, write it out for you and say, this is my God, you know, but... I do know that I trust in it, whatever it is, you know? Like, I have faith that I'm taken care of today, and I have faith that I'm kind of moving in the direction that my higher power wants me to be in. That, you know, I can grow towards being the person my higher power wanted me to be, and that, you know, I wanted to be. I didn't want to be a cheater. I didn't want to be a liar. I didn't want to be a thief, you know? I wanted to be someone who was a man of his word. I wanted to be trusted and loved and respected. And, you know, little by little, I'm becoming worthy of that. And that's not through any merit of my own. That's direct result from being willing to have a higher power enter my life and work through me. And I'm delighted to be here. We have awesome speakers tonight. I am so excited to hear them. So I'm going to shut up. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Dustina.
I'm Dustina. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I just didn't feel like I was going to throw up until about 15 minutes ago. So, but it was really great to hear Jero. Thank you for going first. I'm really honored to be speaking at AA meeting. My sobriety day is July 31st, 2003. I just celebrated 5 years. I just felt like I was going to cry. way too early. Okay. All right. So I just celebrated 5 years sober. And the way that I spent this summer is really different from the way I spent the summer that I got sober. The summer I got sober, I just turned 18 years old. I wanted to die. I mean, that would be the best way to put how I felt. I, you know, woke up every morning with no hope, no real will to live. I was drinking as my solution to that feeling, and it never seemed to work. I couldn't drink enough to get rid of that feeling. It gnawed away at me. It almost felt like physical sometimes, lying in my bed at night. Just, I was so unhappy. And I tried to use alcohol to get rid of that feeling. And it didn't work. And what ended up happening in my life is that, you know, I mean, I started having consequences for my drinking that, you know, I think that's the thing that led me into the rooms. I had a school counselor that I was seeing the whole time that I drank. I only drank about 4 years. And she was one of the few people that I was honest with. And I saw her every week, and I told her what I'd been up to that week, and it just got uglier and uglier and uglier. And, you know, she asked me something that was different from what I'd had doctors talk to me about my drinking, and they always asked me things like, you know, how many drinks do you consume a week, like 6 to 8, 8 to 10, whatever, and, you know, I could not, I don't know, I couldn't tell you. It, you know, didn't mean anything to me, but she asked me, how does drinking make you feel? Like, why do you like drinking so much? And my answer was like, you know, it makes me feel like I can breathe, you know, it makes me feel like I could live just for a second. It just takes away, like, the constant anxiety and fear and just my head. It takes it away just for a second. And she looked at me and she's like, I think you might have a problem. And there was always something different about the way that I drank. I didn't drink until I was 14. I was scared of alcohol because, like Jero, I had, you know, grown up in an alcoholic. I had an alcoholic family, and so, you know, I thought that I was just going to be cautious with alcohol. Or my initial plan was to not drink at all. But I got to high school and I realized that I wouldn't be very cool if I didn't drink at all. So, at my first high school party, you know, people were drinking vodka, and they offered me one, and I drank it kind of the same way I took every drink after that, just with no real thought of the consequences, or everything about why I shouldn't drink just kind of flew out the window, and it's just me and the glass, and I'm like, yeah, why not? And I drank it, and I felt like I could breathe. Like, you know, I was standing in that high school party feeling horribly uncomfortable, as I always did, know, the first time I felt like, you know, a normal person. And, you know, I drank for 4 years, but I didn't drink every day. I didn't even drink every week for a long time. But there was always something different about the way that I drank. There's always something different between me and the people I was drinking with. Because the people I drank with happened to not be alcoholics, but I always ended up having to be taken care of. I was always rolling around, crying, throwing up, you know. I mean, those are the things on the outside that were different from the people around me. But I noticed that there was something different just, like, in the way that I reacted to alcohol. My friends, like, they could take a drink. They could take, like, a sip and then just put it down for, like, an hour. And I could not do that. Like, once I started drinking, it was like something woke up inside of me, and I just needed to feed more. I needed more alcohol. I was like a demon, like, just had to have it. So when that school counselor said, you know, like, I think that you have a problem, I think you might be an alcoholic, I knew that she was right. Like, I knew she was right. But it took me a while to really listen to that. What ended up happening is, you know, they did an intervention and told me that I couldn't, you know, they started taking away things in my life. Like, you can't go away to college, which I plan to do, to come to New York City to go to college, if you don't do something about your drinking. And I was like, fine, whatever. I was really mad at getting caught. That was the thing I was most angry about at the time. So I started going to meetings, and I had no desire to stop drinking. I wasn't a member, I guess. I was just, like, checking it out. I didn't want to stop. Like, why would I stop doing the one thing that I have? Like, I really felt like it was all I had. And why would I want to stop doing it? And what I learned, you know, listening to people was, like, because it doesn't work. That's why, you know, we want to stop. And, you know, I was sitting in meetings for, like, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, totally just in the back, not really wanting to be there at all. And I'm totally a testament to, if you bring the body, the mind will follow, because you people got to me. Like, I related to everything that you said. And I really believed you. Like, the feelings I was describing before about how horrible I felt, I really believed you when you said that you felt like that. And I really believed you when you said you didn't anymore. There's, like, a sincerity. So I figured I'd try it out. But then you told me that I needed to get a higher power. I wanted to stay sober. And I didn't like that idea at all. I was, you know, a petulant teenager. And I think that I think I didn't like God because I didn't think it was cool. So I decided to get, like, a cool God. Like, I made my higher power be the moon. And I didn't try to relate to my higher power at all. I just had one. Like, people would be like, you know, do you have a higher power? I'd be like, yeah, it's a moon. And I didn't pray to it. I didn't, you know, I didn't take any steps or anything. I just had the moon, and I was going to meetings. And didn't have a sponsor. And, you know, things got bad without that higher power. And I was in a meeting, and the topic was spiritual experience. And the speaker was talking about, you know, his spiritual experience. And everybody's talking about their spiritual experiences. And I'm like, I'm never going to have one of those. I don't know what you people are talking about. I don't belong here. I'm just going to go drink. And the speaker said something that really got to me. He was like, I don't even care if there is a higher power or there isn't one. I'm still going to pray to it because that keeps me sober. And I'm like, how could you pray to something you don't even know it's there? So... you know, I walked away from that meeting and I was going to drink, and I had no defense against the first drink, so I went to drink. And I was wandering around, you know, the town trying to find a place to let me in because I'm 18. And I found this one club, and I'm like, I'm going to go in there. That's the club where I'm going to drink. I don't know why, but that's where I'm going to go. And I tried to walk through the door, and the bouncer stopped me, and he was like, hey, girl, what are you doing? And it was this man, Tate, that was at the meeting that I'd just come from. He was a bouncer at this club. So, and I was floored, like, everything just flew out of my head. I couldn't even, like, he looked at me, and he looked in the eye, and he was like, you know, do you really believe there might not be something out there that's looking out for you? And I could not argue with him. I said, maybe. And that's how I began this program, like totally maybe, like, they said, why don't you try praying, you know, and I was like, okay, maybe. And I started praying. I remember getting on my knees the first time by myself. I felt like an idiot because I still didn't believe in God, right? I was just doing it because they told me to do it. And I got on my knees and I was like, you know, what's up? I don't know what I'm talking to, but I'm just saying words out loud on my knees. That was like my first prayer. And you know, something's working because, you know, I've stayed sober this long, and that's basically what I've done pretty much every day since then. There are some days I don't know if I believe in a higher power, just like the man said. And there's some days when I definitely do, but it doesn't matter. Like, I still need to pray to it. I still need to ask that thing to keep me sober, because that's the thing that works. Yeah, and I've done things in sobriety that they're beyond my wildest dreams. You know, I picked up my 5-year chip this year in Paris because I took a big trip, and she's telling me goodbye, but I'm really grateful for my sobriety and all the things that I've gotten to do sober. Thank you.
Tonight, our main speaker is Jeff.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Rossman. I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is November 30th, 1996, and this is my home group. And I sat here for many years fantasizing about standing here. It's nerve-wracking. Figured they're going to have the meeting in the basement tonight. Bob will call me up. Something came up, you know. This is why I keep coming back. I'm a sick man. Normal is a setting on a washing machine. I don't know much more about that. You know, I stand here because I really don't want to die, you know. And I hope that my story may help somebody because I never really understood what was wrong with me. You know, I've had three different modes of operandi. I figured till about maybe age 12, I think I was just coping. I think from 12 to 42, I was kind of existing. And now I think I'm living, you know. I'm going to be 54 on Monday. And when I was a teenager, I never thought I would live to be 25. I really believe that, you know. And that's not from good living. You know, these are not normal thoughts. You know, I don't really remember. Well, I don't really remember too much of anything. I really don't. But I don't remember the first time I took a drink, but I do clearly remember the first time I needed a drink. You know, my parents were divorced when I was 3, so, you know, I felt very different and awkward right from the get-go because there was, like, really nobody I knew whose parents were divorced when I was growing up, you know. I grew up in the late 60s, 70s, and that just wasn't a common thing. And I grew up in Queens in a drive-in court, you know. So when my father would come to pick up my brother and myself for a visiting day, I would, you know, I was in the center of this semicircle drive-in court. I must have been, like, literally 4 or 5 years old. And I remember, like, it was yesterday, walking outside that screen door and feeling like every eye on that court was on me, saying, he's different, look at him. You know, I mean, I felt that. I felt that. I now know what that is, and that's what I've learned here is self-centered fear. And that really, really drove my life. You know, it says in our literature, you know, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And that's my whole life. I loved self-pity. I don't know why it's at the end. To me, it should be at the beginning, because I just bathed in self-pity. I thought that was my solution, to feel sorry for myself, blame you, and anesthetize myself so I could, you know, be inebriated because I couldn't deal with my mind. You know, even sober, I remember I was new, and I had a biopsy, came back negative, and I was disappointed, you know? So it goes to show you how deep it gets. It's insane is what it is. And I learned here what insane really is. It's a complete lack of perspective to think straight. And I have that problem. I also suffer from my can't do the right thing-ism, you know? I love that. Just do the right thing. Well, if I could just do the right thing, I would have done it and I wouldn't be here, you know? I just don't have the needed power to do that a lot of times when I would like to. That's why the book says we needed a power by which we could live. Because I need to live. Because I didn't live most of my life. When I say I don't want to die, I may not be under the ground. But the way I was before I got here, I was not living. No way, no how. I couldn't tell you I liked you. I couldn't tell you I didn't like you. I couldn't approach women. I was so afraid. The guys I grew up with, I felt so inadequate and awkward. I had to lie constantly to tell you some story. Because in my mind, whatever I was and whatever I was doing wasn't good enough for you to like me. I mean, this was an everyday affair. This is a lot of work, you know? And it gets to you. So doing everything here is a piece of cake. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This, to me, has certainly have been the easiest, softer way for me to solve my problem. You know, a dear friend who texted me tonight would always say, my problems are not my problems. My solutions to my problems, they're my problems. Because my solutions were insane, you know, and it started with, you know, with alcohol. I loved alcohol. I never understood I was an alcoholic. I never knew what that meant. But I tell you this much. I remember drinking, throwing up, not liking it, and doing it over and over again as an adolescent teenager. You know, clearly remember that. You know, it started off with, like, God only knows what. When I was 13, you know, there were bar mitzvahs involved in my life because I'm Jewish. And that was it. I had arrived. This is the best thing since sliced bread. Gin and tonics, whiskey sours, and Tarryton cigarettes all for free. You know, I mean, and I'm working the room, you know. I'm loving it. I mean, I felt so good. I mean, alcohol just, you know that there was a show called Love American Style, and it used to start with the bombs going off, you know. And that's what alcohol is, you know. The bombs go off. It's not like, I think normal people may relax, chill out. I don't know what, because I am not that kind of person, so I don't know. I know for me, it's like, let the games begin, okay? And that's the way it was. And the game didn't end until I was almost dead. You know, I tried many different ways to be dead. It's a miracle, purely grace of God, that I stand here today. You know, and I used to think about crashing bar mitzvahs, you know? I mean, I think that was the first insight of the mental obsession that I could go back and find. What normal 13-year-old kid is obsessing over crashing bar mitzvahs? It wasn't to wear a tuxedo or a suit, I can assure you, you know? It was the whiskey sours, the gin and tonics, and the Tarryton cigarettes, you know? And I had a love affair with Boone's Farm Apple Ripple Wine. I remember clearly saying to this day, you know, it's a dollar. This is the cheapest high. It's great. And I used to have collections of Lance's and Matus Rosé, which was popular when I was a kid. You know, she's saying, oh, my God, I don't even know if they make that anymore. And eventually, you know, I just got to, you know, vodka martinis at the end of the day. And, you know, I never could understand or see my problem with alcohol. See, I'd done an enormous amount of other substances, and that really masked my problem with alcohol. And through coming here and doing a lot of work and focusing on my problem with alcohol, I got to see my problem with alcohol. You know, starts off with the beer, then the wine, then the vodka, then the espresso, bottle Sambuca. Don't give me the shot. I'm not taking a shot. I want the bottle. You got to leave the bottle here. And, you know, just drink the espresso, put more Sambuca in, drink more espresso, drink more Sambuca. I mean, the whole purpose of the espresso was to drink more Sambuca. And then after the Sambuca was the port after dinner wine, you know, because I'm Thurston Howell III. I need a port, you know, with Lovey and play, you know, some make-believe head game to drink more alcohol. That's what it boiled down to, more alcohol. I could never see this. When I think back of all these patterns, that's what it was. And I never felt good inside. And alcohol, I've done so many different substances, I can't begin to tell you, but alcohol was the only one that really made me feel, you know what I mean? You know, it just gave me that, like, I'm okay. You know, I learned that I'm physically different than a normal drinker because I have a physical allergy to alcohol. And the way I see that is I was a big bar drinker. I love bars. I was not the kind of alcoholic who drank at home. I didn't hide bottles. I didn't have the shakes, none of that. Doesn't make me alcoholic. But what I did do is I always went to the bar, loved the bar. That's the place where I told my stories. You know, I always had to tell you stories. And I'd always say I'm going to just have a few, meet a nice girl, and that's what I'll do. I don't think that ever happened. I don't know. I might have been in Michigan, and I wouldn't know either, but it never happened. And, you know, I would walk into the bar all the time feeling very awkward and inadequate, you know. But I would have, like, one or two drinks. And, you know, it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, I got the effect with two drinks. I went from the Poindexter to James Bond in two drinks. I'm James Bond. I'm talking Sean Connery. I'm not talking any other James Bond. Although the new guy's pretty cool. And I never understood. You know, it says in the book, it explains many things for which we otherwise cannot account. Now I started to understand why I had 12. I didn't need drinks 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 to get the effect. I got the effect with one or two. It was done. I was feeling great. I wasn't afraid of you. I wasn't afraid of you. I was, no problem. As Vince would say, he's not really such a bad guy, you know? I mean, I was done, but I'm having 10 more drinks. It's because my body craves more than my mind can control. And my ego is telling me all the time, I just want to get wasted. I just want to get messed up because I have to justify my powerlessness. You know, I learned that here. I never understood what was really wrong with me. And the mental obsession. I mean, I remember as clear as day going to Italy a couple of years before I got sober with the greatest conviction I ever had in my life to never drink. And I meant it. I mean, it was strong. And I drank. You know, I drank. You know? You know, there's some story, somehow, some way, that got that booze to my lips. Because I'm, you know, the disease talks a lot about delusion. I'm extremely delusional. I used to drink shots of wheatgrass and protein shakes before binges because I'm concerned with my health. Okay? You know, I mean, and I would always put, like, 20s in my sock so I wouldn't spend it. Like, I don't know what's not there, you know? I mean, I would always, with the mail, I mean, this is how I track my insanity. And I said the same thing about alcohol. Some insane excuse, you know? I mean, really, you know? And I wouldn't even open up the credit card bills. And I really, literally believed. I believed in all my heart and soul, you know, like this is a tile floor. I believed that if I don't open up the envelope, they know I didn't open up the envelope and the debt doesn't commence until the envelope is pierced. I mean, so I had lots of mail. You know, I had lots of mail. And it got worse. I did all kinds of crazy things. I mean, I got beat up by gangsters. I had my ribs broken a few times. I got hit by cars. By the age of 25, things were so good. I was going to a therapeutic community in Ellenville, New York, at 25 years old to live out of the loop of society for a year and a half. And let me tell you, as Bill says in his story, I was welcoming the idea, okay? That's how good my life was going. And I did that. And there was no talk about steps or anything like that, just yelling and screaming and all that nonsense. And you graduate, and they gave me drinking privileges. Now I'm thinking I'm straight because I'm just drinking, you know? I mean, and I just drank for years until eventually I got into the other things as well. But, you know, I mean, it was just many years of just alcohol, bars, lying. I'd always tell people so many stories. I was just never good enough, you know? And always try to fix myself with credit cards, sex, money, lying, conniving, alcohol, you know, drugs, therapy, the therapist, you know, because I was a victim. I love when Stacy always mentions that word, victimese. I spoke it eloquently, you know. It was always you. It was never me. Now it's you're telling me it's me and not you? Yes, that's what I've come to. It's me and not you. But my whole life it was you and not me. And but one thing I got to say that this one therapist did do for me, it was blatantly obvious to her that I had an enormous problem with another substance, so she sent me to a 12-step program that catered to that substance. And that was the first time I ever went to a 12-step meeting. And on that day, I was completely willing to stop that substance. But they told me, you can't drink alcohol. And so I left. And I stayed out there for another 2 years. So that's how much of a problem I have with alcohol. I couldn't stop it. First of all, I didn't even think I had a problem with it. You know, but eventually, you know, at the end of November 1996, coming out of a bar, daylight, you know, hanging out with these two girls in an apartment, I was an emaciated, pale ghost, like a vampire freak. I looked in the mirror. I had that moment of clarity many people here I've heard have, you know, and I knew I couldn't go on anymore. Now, I don't know much about God or anything like that at the time. My whole conception when I got here of a higher power is priests, rabbis, and ministers are all losers. They got no life. They wear costumes, and they certainly don't know how to roll a joint. So that's the way I looked at this, literally. I'm not even trying to be funny. I believe that. You know, and like Justina was saying, you know, I thought Christ had to be cool because we're talking about him. I mean, the guy's, you know, we're still talking about him. It's got to be cool. And that's all I had. That's it. Nothing more. So I just knew I couldn't do this anymore. And I don't know why on that given day, to this day, I've never had the desire to drink. I don't know if that would have remained that way had I not done what I do. And I don't need to find that out either. So I came to meetings, and I got a sponsor within 30 days, and I got a service commitment within 30 days, and I got a home group, and I got very involved. The first conclusion I ever came to was, there's no getting over. You know, I thought I was so cool. I got all the raps. I know everything about what I know nothing about. And you can't tell me because I know. Yeah, but I know. Yeah, but I know. Yeah, but I know. Everything's good. Everything's good. Everything's good. Yeah, but I know. I know. Yeah, but everything's good. Yeah, but I know. I know. You know? And I realized right then and there, my skinny little butt sitting on that wrought iron folding chair, there's just no getting over. Look where I am. La-di-da-da. You know, and that was a gift. To really understand that. That was a gift because I'm convinced of that. And I got very busy. You know, did step work with my sponsor in the way he knew how with other methods than I've learned here. And I just wanted to be happy. You know, I've never been happy. I've been a miserable soul my whole life. Very dark, very unhappy, very angry and afraid. And that's all I really craved for when I got here. You know, it was happiness. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to get it, but I knew that's what I wanted. And things weren't working out. The puck wasn't getting in the net, you know? And I kept showing up, and I didn't know what was wrong. Then one day, I followed this girl to a meeting that had just started. It was a big book study meeting. And I heard something I really never heard or never was open to hear, which was the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that day changed my entire life because I knew right then and there what I wanted, what I needed, and I asked one of those two people who was facilitating that meeting if they would sponsor me. And she was a 34-year-old woman, I was a 42-year-old man, and we had everything in common, alcoholism. She told me, you got to drop your sponsees, you don't know nothing. I'm going to get together with this book, go page by page, line by line, and I did that. And then I found out what was wrong with me. I found out I was bodily and mentally different. I find out I knew I couldn't fix myself. I tried every which way. That's what's so insane about this place. Everyone comes here because they lost the game of trying to fix themselves. And again, they're still thinking that they can fix themselves. Baffling. But that's why I'm insane. Because to believe that is insanity. Because I tried that. I couldn't do it. I can't do it. And I never will. I need to keep seeking power. And that power will heal me. It will give me the strength to tell you no when I need to say no. It'll give me the strength to say yes when I need to say yes. It'll give me the courage to stand up here and do whatever and to deal with the things I had to, you know, in life. And when I got to the third step in the book, that sold me on the whole program because that was like my autobiography. If only the whole planet would live and breathe and react and respond the way I think they should, I'm okay, you know? And that's just not the way it is. That, I realized why I was so miserable my whole life. Why I had to drink. I had to drink. When you operate in that mode all day long, It's brutal.
You know what I mean?
It's brutal. I mean, you know, I've been working the same job 18 years, and I wanted to leave it twice. And twice I realized it's me and not them. I have a great job. My only problem is Jeffrey Rossman. That's my problem. So I don't think I'm going to be the solution either. And when I took my inventory and did a fourth and fifth step, I stopped being a victim. That's when it ended. I'm just not a victim anymore. I know it's me. And if I can't get there immediately or shortly thereafter, I will seek help to get there. You know, because if I'm disturbed, I know there's something that I'm not seeing about the truth with myself. You know, if it's not going away. Because I've said I'm a pilot made amends and that still lingers because I'm not getting to the real deal. That's where my sponsor comes in. Because I can't see what I can't see. And, you know, my greatest motivation to change, I was just so afraid nobody would ever like me. It's just that simple. Fear motivated me to change. I do it more now today because I just want to be a better guy, be more of a gentleman, you know. And I made right with the world, you know. I mean, I made right with the world. And then I started to pass this on to other people. And that's when I finally found meaning and purpose in life. I spent so many years of my life just killing time. Killing time. Well, it's 2 o'clock. I got nothing to do till never. You know? I mean, it's just killing time. And when I started sponsoring people, my whole life changed. All of a sudden, there's meaning and purpose. Why I didn't die when people had guns to my head. Why I didn't die when I had ribs broken. Why, when I have high blood pressure, taking substances that would kill you didn't kill me. You know, why all those things went on and I'm here. Because I'm here to help people who have helped me and give back what was so freely given to me. And I'll tell you what I've learned here. You know, I'll tell you, there's one story I got to tell. You know, about, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I sponsored one woman, took her through the steps, and she's an actress. And she was co-starring in a Broadway show. And I went to the opening night party that they had at the Russian Tea Room. And I'm sitting next to a guy whose name I've been watching on credits since I'm a little kid. And he asked me a question, one of two questions I can't stand. The first one I can't stand is why you're not married. And the second one is what do you do for a living? You know, even when I got sober, I told people I was an artist. And I am an artist. I couldn't lie, but I couldn't tell you what I did. You know, that's how I came in here. You know? But he asked me, what do you do for a living? And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, I sell phone systems. And at the time I was doing improv and I paint, I draw. But I just looked him in the eye and said, I sell phone systems because that's what I do for a living. And I realized, without realizing it, you know, that I had gotten somewhere with all that peace, you know, that I'm okay. That's the power working in me. It's not Jeffrey Rossman. Without this in my soul and heart, you wouldn't see me. You know, it's going to be a bad show. I have evidence. You know, and that really meant a lot to me. And, you know, I've gotten to see a lot in sobriety, you know. I got to be a good son to my father and mother, and they both passed away when I was sober, and my aunt, and I was able to be there and not have any regrets. Gee, I wish I would have did this, and I wish I would have done that. That, fortunately for me, I had that opportunity of many years sober with my mother and my father. And, you know, I found that I had hepatitis C in sobriety, and I was able to get rid of hepatitis C in sobriety. And some of that was all going on at the same time. I had my teeth ripped out, my mother dying, and taking interferon with rivaroxaban for hepatitis all at the same time. And I showed up here with a smile, and I never complained, and I was of service because you showed me I could. You showed me that I could do that. Because I've seen the power working in you, doing things to help you and me do things that I'm just not capable of. You know, and I see it every day. I have a friend sitting out here tonight I used to get inebriated with. So I know there's a power greater than me working in everybody here. Because why are we here? You know, so these are many, many wonderful gifts. I finally got that level of happiness that I was looking for on day one. You know, I don't have, you know, a girlfriend relationship. I'm weak in that area. And I'm okay, you know? I'm okay. Some people are, they're not. I am. You know, I'm not okay in other things, you know what I mean? You got blue, I got red. You know, I've learned every time I judge, I learn how much I don't know the whole truth. So it's difficult to judge. I'll go there because I'm human, but I'll also leave there, you know? But I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's shown me how I could live with the kind of illness I have. I'm not cured. I'll never be cured. I have a deadly illness that will kill me. I look at it like this. This is my own perception, but it's really a Mark P. kind of analogy. My disease is like a star running back in football. This guy is the best thing since sliced bread. And my spiritual program has to be a very good defensive line. And if that defensive line gives that runner a little hole, he's going to bolt for some yardage. And I can't afford too much yardage because I could die. You know, I take this very serious. This is all about life and death. I love schmoozing. I love kidding around. A lot of you know me. I'm a clown. But you know something? This is life and death. When they say, can you do this? Yes. Will you mop? Will you pick up the chicken? No problem. You know, I mean, this is life and death. And if I forget that for 1 minute, you know, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. You know, the book gives a lot of warnings, you know, and I take it very seriously. You know, I have seen this illness, you know, the whiskey and the milk on the full stomach. I've had that analogy in so many ways in my life. Of being delusional to buy a concept that's dangerous to justify doing something that's insane. I mean, it's just insane. My mind is extremely, you know, it says many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. They didn't say, it's not so good. You know? Very sick person. I am that person who needs to comprehend that I'm a very sick person. Doesn't mean I have to be ill all the time. But the one thing I'm grateful for is that I embrace that principle every darn day. You know, I take this very seriously. I'm telling you, I'll meet guys, they'll tell you. In the afternoon on a beach day, no problem. You know, whatever it is. Because I know what I think I want isn't what I want. I learned that here. What I think I want isn't what I want. My alcoholism says I want to go to the beach and look at bikinis. But what I really want is self-esteem, integrity, and character. Somehow I can't get it like that, you know? Go figure. But you see, you got to do enough work to be able to see the truth. Because, you know, it's said very simply, you know, after a time I couldn't differentiate between the true and the false. You know, that guy up there said, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." I love that line. I'm a Jewish guy. I learned that in church. That's what the 11th step did for me. How do you like that? I went from that conception to doing that. So when your mind is open, it's amazing how far you can go and the things you can do in life. You know, I mean, my biggest enemy is always going to be me. It's me. It's always me. You know, I was at a 10-step meeting last night, and I was sharing, and I said, you know, this is the step, really. It's like that Seinfeld line. You're telling me it's you and not me? Yes. You know, but I'm glad that I could have the ability to seek the truth, because really, it's the only thing that has ever freed me and given me the peace and happiness that I wanted when I got here. But what I learned is that I really don't know on my own how to go about doing that, you know, and that's where I need a lot of help, you know, and I'm always kind of scanning myself like a virus scan on a computer, you know, I am, I do that. I always look and check my motives. I can't tell you how many emails and texts, no, I don't know how you say it, text plural, but I discard and close and don't send because, you know, my motives are purely self-seeking. I mean, a lot of them slip by. Don't get me wrong. I'm no saint. I'll spend the rest of the night telling you how great I am. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with that. But you know, I'm trying, you know, with the guy I am to be helpful to other people, to be of service. You know, when my father passed away and my mother passed away before that, and my stepmother, who's been married to my father almost 50 years, who was the woman I was never supposed to like, you know, my relationship with her became a whole principle of the St. Francis prayer. You know, it's better to love than to be loved, to understand than to be understood, it's truly by self-forgetting that one finds. And I have found, as a result of doing that, I have developed an incredible relationship with my stepmother that I never thought I could have. You know, Vince said something to me that was miraculous. Simple line in the book, when all that was going down, you know, it's the deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And that includes your stepmother. And you know something? That's the truth. And the last thing I'll say, you know, in closing is, you know, my brother is also in this program. Some of you know him. And Mother's Day, we would always go out to his house in Long Island, you know. So one time he asked my mother if she would rather go spend it with me in Manhattan. And my mother said something I hold very dear to my heart. She said, every day for me is Mother's Day because both my sons are sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.